Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Thursday. Thanks for joining me. This is Rini. This is Rini's Heart to Heart. And this morning, we have a few topics that I want to talk about. But before I forget again, I hope all my Jewish friends will forgive me for forgetting yesterday to wish all of you a Happy New Year. I had it written right here in my notes and just got busy and forgot. Please forgive me. I know it's an important time of year for all of you, and I have tremendous respect for the history and the lifestyle of the Jewish persuasion. I think it's something to be very proud of. I would like to, first of all, mention a couple bad things that have happened in the last couple days. And we're going to discuss them a little bit. Then I have something that hopefully will lift you up. First of all, yesterday in Texas, there were a bunch of teens who got into a fight. And in the school, in a high school, in Spring High School in Houston, Texas. And apparently there's been a war going on between them. And the authorities are calling it possibly gang and rivalry going on with these young people. And they were right in the lunchroom, and they broke into a fight, and one of the boys was stabbed and killed in the class. I'm going to read a little bit about this just to get everybody to understand. Even though I'm an advocate for teenagers and young people, because I think they become who they are through no fault of their own, I believe that it's our leadership that is where the problem stems from. And you're supposed to lead the way you want to be followed. And we are. We are being followed the way we're leading. Our kids are doing horrible things to each other. And it gets worse every day, but this seems like such a waste. It says, a teen student was stabbed to death and three others were injured in a possible gang-related confrontation Wednesday at Spring High School in the Houston suburb of Spring, Texas, Harris County. Three students described as persons of interest were taken into custody after the fight in a hallway leading into the school cafeteria. At least two were taken away in handcuffs. The sheriff's office later said they were questioning a 17-year-old boy as the only suspect. Spring High School, which serves 3,000 students, that's a big school, was locked down and classes were canceled the rest of the week. Garcia, he is the sheriff, said that the stabbing occurred around 7:10 a.m. and may have been gang-related. He said the incident started with a physical confrontation involving a cutting instrument. Investigators have not found the weapons involved. Authorities have not named the dead student, but several news reports identified him as Joshua Broussard, a 17-year-old sophomore. The television studio in that area spoke with a man who said he was the father of the slain teen. "He was just trying to come to school today," he said of his son. The victim's aunt, who identified herself as Alyssa Broussard, said the killing was random. The sheriff and two students were taken to the hospital with minor injuries, and the third was undergoing surgery. One of the injured teens was stabbed in the abdomen and had been listed in critical condition at Memorial Hermann Hospital, but later his condition was upgraded to good. The TV station had previously quoted a family member as saying the boy was fighting for his life. Now, this part bothers me. I'm not sure how I would handle it, but this part for me is one of the worst things that happened this day. At mid-morning, the school sent out an email and a recorded message to parents. Now, let's remember, most parents, yes, we all have our iPhones and cell phones and what have you to get emails, but most of us are at work, or most of us are, you know, doing what we do during the day when our kids are safe in school. This is an important message from Spring High School based on a preliminary report. A fight occurred this morning in the cafeteria. There has been one fatality, and three students have been transported to hospitals with injuries. All other students are safe in their classrooms and will remain there while the investigation continues. Students will be released as soon as we have been given permission from investigating authorities. We will call you again as soon as we have more details. Now, can you imagine getting a message like that on your phone or on your email? Good Lord. When street violence pours into the school, it compromises the well-being of all of our students, said Ralph Draper, the Spring ISD superintendent, at a news conference outside the school. It is our aim to reestablish a safe and secure place for students on campus. He also said that police arrived within 60 seconds of being summoned. That's a little far-fetched. I can't believe that he's telling us that they made a phone call and police were there within 1 minute. Garcia said the campus has no metal detectors. And the local pastor said he was serving as a spokesman for the family of one of the victims and said the incident was part of an ongoing battle involving young men of different races. We as a community need to come together and show kids the value of real life, adding that this was not gang violence, but simply a misunderstanding between two people. It sounds to me as though there's a lot of unanswered questions, and it sounds to me as though there could be a lot more going on here that we're not hearing about. So on that note, I want to say that schools have to be safe. Schools have to be guarded, which is very sad for me. But even 30 years ago, there were policemen here in the schools in Florida. It was not unusual for me to walk into Deerfield Middle School and see the campus cop, who all the kids knew, and it created a little bit of safety. Although Deerfield Middle School was notorious for problems and still is to this day. I'm going to bring in Shelley before we have any more discussions about some of these things, but I'd like to hear Shelley's input on the story that I just read. Good morning, Shelley.
Good morning, Rainey.
How are you?
Doing pretty good, and you?
I'm good. I wasn't on my dashboard, so I don't know how long ago you clicked in. Did you hear the story I just read about the school in Texas?
I don't think I heard it from the beginning, but I heard what happened. I mean, I heard that this one boy stabbed another one, but I near the very, very beginning, so I don't know how the confrontation unfolded or you know, any of those details.
Well, that's because they weren't given, so you didn't miss anything.
Uh-oh.
I just don't have that. It was three kids in a high school in Texas, and apparently there's been a problem, and there was a stabbing, and one of the boys is dead, and
wow.
The other three boys, one boy is in the hospital, and the other two are okay, but a very... I don't know. Well, and then the last comment there that the police arrived in 60 seconds made me kind of laugh, because I believe that about as much as I do in the Tooth Fairy. So, but what it did for me was remind me that all the talking that we do about our leadership and our roles in our leadership are supposed to be teaching our kids, and they're supposed to follow in our footsteps, and that's really what's happening. The same kind of crime and just attitude about each other is filtering down to the 17-year-olds. And we can't ostracize them for it because it's what they see every day in the world of adults. So it's sad. And then the message that they sent out to the families, I can't even imagine getting a message like that. I'd have been beside myself. You know, it doesn't even give names of who the kids were that were involved. You have to hope that if your kid was one of them, they've already gotten in touch with you. But do you know it by that message?
No, I thought that message was extremely irresponsible. Whatever school authority made the decision to do that needs their head examined. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
It was ridiculous.
First of all, they should have notified the four parents privately, you know, and then sent a message like that out to all the parents saying this is not involving your child. However, at the school this happened, so that you know it's not your child, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have notified the other four parents involved that their children were involved, but it shouldn't have been in an email. It should have been in a personal call. So, whoever did that, that's ridiculous. Because now you're just setting widespread panic amongst everybody else, and it's terrible. That's somebody that just didn't really think through their actions.
Well, and of course, you know, there is the fact that whenever something happens to you the first time, it's the first opportunity you've ever had to handle it. And often you make mistakes. I understand that. I appreciate that. But in your role, in a very important role, in a school district, you really should be ready to do things like that and prepared and have things organized and know the important points that you have to touch on. And I think hindsight is always very, very good. And when you're in the middle of a trauma and everything, often you make mistakes. I remember reading quotes from myself after things have happened, and I thought, what the hell made me say that? But as a administrator in a school, you need to be prepared. You need to be ready to do anything like that. So. Now, this next story.
But look at it this way. There's so much of this, unfortunately, I mean, I hate even making a comment like that. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah,
but there's
I hear
so
you
much,
fine,
okay. There's so much going on of this nature, okay, that schools nationwide should already have protocols in place. It shouldn't be that, oh my God, this happened and what do we do, and everybody's scrambling on how to handle it. It's not like 10 years ago when the first violent incident happened, that this is something that all schools should be prepared for. And before we continue, I wanted to make one comment because it's kind of relative to what we're talking about right now. I helped my young niece, my niece's daughter, so it's my great niece, for the school project this past weekend. She's 10 years old, and she had to create a brochure and a newsletter. Okay, a trifold brochure and a 4-page newsletter on two different books she read, and the instructions were like instructions that, first of all, a couple of the adults that tried to help her with it didn't even understand the instructions. Since I'm trying to write a book. Can you hear me now?
Yep, you're back.
Okay. So what I'm saying is the instructions that she was given were more along the lines of what somebody in business would be given. I understood the instructions because I'm trying to create this book, okay? But a couple of the other adults didn't understand. They were struggling with how to help her. She didn't really understand it. And I'm reading the instructions, and first of all, it was like higher-level stuff. It's learning how to use word processors in a computer and stuff like this. And I'm thinking about it, you know, they're cramming these kids full of skills. So they're teaching them skills on top of skills earlier and earlier, but they're not teaching them how to cope with life. They're not teaching them how to cope with stress. They're not teaching them how to respect each other. They're not teaching them life skills. they're teaching them skills. That's not what school is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be just skills. It's supposed to be preparing you for adult life. And if you don't have the right attitude toward your life, you can have all the skills you want to have. You're going to be a crappy person, and you're going to live a crappy life. So it's like they're putting too much emphasis on knowledge and not teaching these kids what the importance of that knowledge is, what the importance of life is, what the importance of being respectful to each other and having reasonable expectations on how people are going to treat you. And this is a huge issue. School is supposed to train kids for adult life, and it's falling way short.
Well, part of that problem is the fact that we are reversing the roles. They want the parents, like you did this weekend, to help with the homework. They want to hand out assignments and have mom and dad and Aunt Shelley and Grandma Bonnie help with the homework. And then they want to take responsibility for the social skills because they must want that, because otherwise they'd leave us time to spend time with the kids and develop their social skills. That's the way it was supposed to be set up, and it's no longer true. Because if you spend every weekend, AJ's only 6. Diana's working now at night. She leaves here at 5:00. AJ gets home at about 2:30. From 2:30 until almost 4:00, they do homework. He's in first grade.
That's ridiculous.
He had to take pictures this week that Diana had put on the printer. AJ doesn't know how to do that. He's 6. Print out the picture, put them on my computer, print them out on the printer, and then make a book and tell a story about the pictures. It came out wonderful. Diana got an A+, I think. You know, AJ, he did very little. So, but in the meantime, they could have been at the park. They could have been swimming in the pool. They could have been doing things, talking, and establishing good family momentum. Instead, and I've complained about this for the past 4 years, this homework thing and these assignment things, yes, you need to give them assignments that they need to take responsibility for and accomplish. I get that, and I appreciate that. But to give them homework that they don't even get the gist of, and this is still happening as they get into high school, although now high school, your 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade is treated like college. You don't do your homework? Okay. No, there's no repercussions. You just, you know, it's a 30-year grade, and that's how it gets counted. If you can make straight A's in the classroom working in your exams and your mini quizzes and stuff like that, no teacher says anything to you about not doing your homework as long as you can keep your grade point average up.
The whole point is that I'm not saying that I don't think kids should be taught skills. I mean, obviously they need skills, and we're in a different age than we were when I was a kid. So obviously a lot of the things they're learning are going to be beneficial in the workforce. My criticism is that I think they're cramming too much skills and not enough life lessons. And I do think it's the school's responsibility to teach kids. Why aren't they teaching kids how to balance their checkbook? Why aren't they teaching them true life skills so that when they get out of school and they go to work and they start earning a paycheck, that they're not in debt in the first year? Why aren't kids taught about credit card debt? Why aren't they taught about things like that? And these are the type of classes that are needed in school, not all this stuff. Unless she works at a desk job doing what I do, she's never even going to use that skill that she learned this weekend. I work in a company with almost 300 people, and there's maybe 8 of us that would use the skill that she learned this weekend. Because nobody at my company uses those particular picture tools unless you're in some sort of graphic design. It's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I don't want to sound like I think I could do a better job than a teacher, because I don't think I could. And I think teachers have a tough job in front of them. And I think, just like the story that I just read, you know, there's always some kind of drama and trauma going on. And they have to deal with that as well. And I have a couple family members who are teachers who take it very seriously. And you and I have had a couple teachers on the show that are awesome. And
I'm not criticizing the teachers, by the way. I'm criticizing the school board. I'm not criticizing the teachers. I'm criticizing the school boards because
right.
they're the
okay.
ones that set the curriculum.
Shelley said she's not criticizing teachers. She's criticizing the school board and the way things are set up, for those of you who
right.
didn't hear that.
Right.
Well, again, I think a lot of it has to be reassessed because times have changed. It's like so many of our things that were set up in the late 1800s that are so antiquated now that they no longer fit us. It's like an old seersucker suit, for God's sakes. Get rid of it. So it's just we are changing and we're evolving and we have all these new innovations every day and all these ways for, I mean, to be honest with you, if a kid is really really good with all of their doodads, you know, their iPhones and their iPads and their this and their that, they can get any kind of help they want whenever they want it, even in a classroom to accomplish a test, an assignment, anything. They can do all of that. So it does need to be revisited. And I think because of this conversation, I didn't know it was going to evolve into this, but because of this conversation, I think we will organize an opportunity to bring in another teacher and discuss some of these things on a show next week and see what we can do and see how the teachers actually feel. I'll try to find somebody who's in a little bit higher grade elementary school and let them talk to us and give us some feedback. So I think that would be a great show. But I'm going to move on.
Yeah, that would be a great show, too.
Yeah. I'm going to move on, and I think I'm going to write myself a quick note so I don't forget that. Okay. But I do want to on something that was sent to me yesterday on Facebook by a very dear person who has been a friend of mine since my grandson was hurt. She is an avid computer person, and she listens to the show often, and he was a victim of Sandy in Jersey and now has relocated here in Miami. But she sent me this story because it's out of New Jersey, and very sadly, I know this happens every day, and it caught my eye, and it kind of upset me, and if you go to my Facebook page, you have an opportunity to go to the ACLU and like this and see if we can do something for this poor gentleman. The story starts by showing a picture of an elderly gentleman. He is 74 years old. He's sitting in a hotel room. At least that's what it looks like. And it says, the Bill of Rights no longer applies to Ken Schmidt. He can't vote, sign a lease, get married, or open a bank account. Schmidt, 74, had many of his civil rights stripped away after he fell head outside his Toms River home in January 2012. So this has been going on 2 years. A judge declared him to be mentally incapacitated and ordered the state public guardian to take charge of Schmidt's assets and medical care under New Jersey's guardian laws. With one false, the retired insurance salesman plunged headlong into a bureaucratic system he has not been able to climb back out of. Even though he says he's fully recovered a year ago, he walks under his own power, writes coherently in a clear and steady hand, enjoys James Patterson thrillers, as does my husband, and is conversant in such wide-ranging topics as the A-Rod steroid scandal, Obamacare, and the recent bloodshed in Egypt. Yet, until a judge says otherwise, Schmidt can't even receive his own mail, nor can he leave the $5,000 a month assisted living facility in which the state placed him more than a year ago. He can't return home to the townhouse he owns, mortgage-free, just 6 miles away. I never wanted this. I never asked for this. They just buried me here, Schmidt said. I want life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I want my life back, first and foremost, but nobody seems to care. Schmidt's predicament is a cautionary tale of how quickly someone's civil rights and life savings can be swept away, and just how difficult it can to get a judgment of incapacity lifted. In addition to his home, Schmidt had more than $65,000 in the bank prior to his accident. He said the care manager assigned to him by the Office of the Public Guardian told him those funds were exhausted paying for his care. It's all gone.
Oh, my God.
Classic answer. I'm sorry. It's all gone. And they won't give me anything in writing, Schmidt said. Everything's just disappeared. The state's guardianship system is a critical safety net for tens of thousands of disabled and vulnerable individuals. But the system is shrouded in secrecy. Court documents in guardianship cases aren't public records. The identities of wards and their guardians aren't publicly disclosed. And no one keeps track of how many active guardianship cases there are statewide. All guardians, except for the public guardian, are required to file an annual update on the incapacitated person's condition and care and an accounting of how the person's assets are being spent. In Schmidt's case, the public guardian, a post currently held on an acting basis by Helen C. Dodick, doesn't have to account for how his money was spent until he dies, according to the judge's order. How lovely.
Oh, my God.
Meanwhile, privacy rules prohibit the Office of the Public Guardian from commenting on Schmidt's case. An agency spokeswoman said Schmidt could sign a release to waive his privacy rights, but because he's still legally considered to be incapacitated, he can't sign anything, at least not without his guardian's permission. Good Lord. I have no rights. I'm not allowed to do anything, Schmidt said. State has too much power. I know that they are helping people, and people do need help. But they just assumed I wouldn't rehabilitate. It's the rare person who tries to get out from under the guardianship, which requires the filing of a petition in state superior court. In the vast majority of guardianship cases, the incapacitated person has progressive dementia that only worsens over time. Jeffrey M. Moran, the Ocean County surrogate, said his office typically handles no more than 2 or 3 requests a year from wards or their guardians to dissolve a guardianship. The process requires affidavits from 2 doctors, or a doctor and a psychologist, attesting that the person has sufficiently recovered to have his or her personal rights restored. Without the cooperation of their guardians or families, however, wards like Schmidt are at a distinct disadvantage. There are significant impediments to regaining your rights, said Attorney Robert F. Brogan, past president of the New Jersey chapter of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. Good God. You have no access to funds, and you have no legal ability to contract with anyone to help you. How do you hire a doctor? How do you hire a lawyer when the court has taken away your ability to engage in contracts? Such restrictions are proper and necessary to protect a truly incapacitated ward from making critical mistakes, such as giving $50,000 away to the vacuum salesman, Brogan noted. But when a ward is no longer incapacitated, the restrictions of an indefinite guardianship can be difficult to bear. Your life can really be turned upside down. Schmidt's problems began with a fall outside his townhouse. Actually, it was 2 falls. Rushing out the door to get to the local Stop and Shop before it closed, he stumbled in the dark and hurt his shoulder. He went back inside to gather himself. Then, still woozy, he ventured out again. This time he hit the sidewalk hard, hitting his head. He doesn't remember much after that and doesn't dispute that he needed a guardian at that point. I was in Palookaville, he admitted. Oh, that's an old fighting term. That's funny. Schmidt,
yeah, I know.
First clear memory after the accident is waking up in a rehabilitation hospital weeks later. In March 2012, he started keeping a memory book. or journal. Body is responding to therapy, must find eyeglasses and dentures. Brain remembering slowly, reads one of his earliest entries. Smith said he wasn't present at his guardianship hearing before State Superior Court John A. Peterson, Jr. in Ocean County. The hearing was initiated that February by Community Medical Center and the Toms River Hospital where Smith initially was treated. The judge's order issued April 25th, 2012, states that as a result of unsoundness of mind, Schmidt was incapable of governing himself and managing his affairs and unable to consent to medical treatment. Often, a family member will agree to serve as the incapacitated person's legal guardian, but Schmidt, who is divorced and has been estranged from his two daughters for many years, had no one to take that responsibility. In such cases, a judge usually will appoint the public guardian to act on the person's behalf. Currently, the public guardian is responsible for 1,184 individuals. Oh, my Lord. Each case is assigned to a care manager, a social worker, who is supposed to visit the person to assess his needs on a regular basis.
Read that last sentence again. You cut out for a minute. I wanted to hear what that stat was.
Currently, the public guardian is responsible for 1,184 individuals.
Oh,
each
wow.
case is assigned to a care manager or a social worker who is supposed to visit the person to assess his needs on a regular basis. With 31 care managers on staff, caseload works out to about 38 clients per worker. The judge's order awarded fees to the various professionals involved in the hearing. The doctor who examined him, $350. The hospital's attorney, $2,075. The court-appointed attorney who represented him at the hearing, $1,440. And another attorney who served as Schmidt's temporary guardian, $2,852. All drawn from Schmidt's assets. It's like legalized robbery. They're already on the first talking about dividing up my estate, Schmidt said, reviewing a copy of the five-page judgment. There's nothing in there about a recheck of his condition. Based on his conversations with his care manager, Schmidt said he was led to believe his townhouse had been sold or somehow was repossessed by the bank that gave him a reverse mortgage in 2005, but that's not the case. Township's tax records still list Schmidt as the property owner, along with the Office of the Public Guardian. The property taxes have been kept up to date. The public guardian would have had to have filed a petition with the court to request permission to sell the property. But apparently he would have been able to if that got okay. That's kind of scary as well. And with a reverse mortgage, it goes back to the bank anyway, so that sounds like a whole other scam to me. Earlier this month, Schmidt visited his townhouse complex with a reporter. His unit's shades were drawn, and it appeared to be dark inside. Cobwebs covered the front door. I fall right here on the sidewalk, two steps from my door, he said, and my life ended. Schmidt said his care manager repeatedly has discussed having him moved into an apartment in an adult community in Lakewood. But he wonders why he would have to rent an apartment if he still owns a townhouse. Why can't he simply go home? Why am I out here? He said, standing outside his townhouse. I should be inside watching television or something. 3 days after Gannett, New Jersey talked. 3 days after Gannett, New Jersey talked to talked to a spokeswoman for the Office of the Public Guardian. Schmidt said he was visited by his care manager and an attorney from the state. Schmidt said they promised to look into his questions about what's become of his home and personal possessions. They also discussed transitioning him out of the guardianship, providing he can demonstrate that he can live on his own during a supervisory period lasting perhaps 2 to 3 months. They say everything will happen rapidly now. After learning about Schmidt's situation from the newspaper, Moran, the surrogate, called the Office of Public Guardian to inquire about the status of his case. At this point, Schmidt isn't sure what, if anything, will happen next. He is Eventually, he is allowed to return home. He hopes his pension and Social Security benefits will be enough for him to live on. The moral of the story is to never be alone. Oh, Schmidt said, have family around you. Put yourself up in a position where things like this can't happen. Is that not an unbelievably sad and upsetting story?
Oh, my God, yes.
And again, it
leads to people in power making mm-hmm. inappropriate decisions. It's several of the people involved here. To take somebody who fell, you know, it's one thing to put somebody in long-term incapacitation if they're suffering from dementia, which is something that in most cases you don't come back from. But if the incapacitation is caused from a physical injury, we heal. There should have been a 6 months down the road or 10 months down the road to have him reevaluated.
Well, you just answered the whole dilemma, Shell, by what you just said. Nobody did any kind of assessment of the fact that he just didn't wake up one day and have dementia or some kind of depression or mental illness like we have talked about a million times on this show. He hit his head.
Right.
He hit his head. Hitting his head, he was fine. I mean, we've read stories on this show, and I know that we've all read stories personally of people who've been comment. Remember the show I did about people that have been in comas?
Yeah.
And the story
yep.
I told about my own Michael being able to hear me and wanting to talk when he was in a stage 5 coma after being hit on the head.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was certainly incapacitated. He was in a coma for 10 days.
Right.
You know, but he, you know, obviously he got better and better and better and better. So I think, and what added in here, of course, was this man's age. They figured, God, he's 70. Let's sing his swan song for him. And in the meantime, we'll take his villa and we'll take his 65 grand and we'll pay all the appropriate people that can do the job. You know, there's people waiting in line to collect people's savings once they are out of it. You know what I'm saying? There's people that are waiting in line, lawyers, doctors, nurses. The only organization, and I know I say this a lot, but it's true, the only organization that steps up to the plate that is not a government-run organization is hospice. Hospice are the only ones that will come and take care of you, and money is not the issue. If you have insurance, they'll take insurance payments, but they don't turn anybody away. And they certainly don't through your records to find out what your assets are and find out if you're going to be worthy enough for them to spend time with. So this is a very sad story. So what we did is on my Facebook page, you can sign in. I requested every friend, which is over 400 people, to click on the ACLU and let them know that we're all paying attention to what's happening to this young man.
This gentleman,
if we can't get him back in his home and out of this mess that he's in. And again, if he did refinancing, because I've looked into that for myself and for other people, it is an amazing thing that you can do, but on your demise, you don't sell that house. It goes back to the bank. That's probably where the 65 grand came from that was in his savings account. So
say that again? Where did the 65 go?
Probably from the reverse mortgage on his villa.
Oh, right.
You know,
I see,
if he did a
reverse
mortgage, then what happens is he gets a cash value. If he didn't owe a lot of money on it, then, you know, you get a lot of money to live on and keep yourself comfortable. But then, and he has no family, so it was the perfect scenario for him to do a refinancing. But that means that they can't sell that villa. That's why it's sitting there empty, because it still belongs to the bank.
Oh, boy, right.
You know? Now he's 65 grand that was going to help him live more comfortably and have extra money in case he needed it, et cetera, et cetera. So now because they've just filtered through his grand not quite 2 years span, if something does happen to Mr. Schmidt, he'll be taken care of by the government this time.
I just find it astonishing that they came up with inside of a couple of years, because I mean, you look at most elderly people, they live very conservatively, and how they found ways to spend $65,000 of his money inside of a couple of years is astonishing.
Well, it's because they have them in a center, and they're expensive. I read that the one he lives in, it costs them $5,000 a month.
Wow, think about that. That's mm-hmm. like a Park Avenue apartment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, like I said, there's lots of people who realize those kind of things. I just spent time with a very close friend, and her relative was a veteran, so the VA helped him, and then the government helped him until his demise, and he didn't have any assets to speak of. But they still cared for him, and they cared for him with quality care. So we are doing a lot of things right out there. But then you get something like this that happened, and nobody's paying attention. So I'm glad. Thank you. If you're listening out there, you can send me stories like that whenever you want, and we'll do whatever we can. I think that this poor gentleman needs to have some voices behind him, and now he does. So, and this is interesting, and perhaps we will look into this for another show at another time as well, about what happens to people when they lose their independence. And if they're in a position with family, it's one thing. If they're in a position without family, it would be interesting to see exactly what happens. My daughter is helping somebody right now and helped somebody about 6 or 7 months ago. It's a huge family, but there was still all kinds of problems going on with his family and over money and home and things like that. So it's an interesting topic. Now, this that I want to share with everybody is incredibly uplifting. I read this and I read it twice because it really, really moved me. And I want to share it with everybody. Let me see if I can pull it up now. It's a teacher, and he did a lesson in his class, and it's amazing. It's really, really amazing what he does. Let me see now if it'll come up. Now it's not going to let me. Saved it to my main page, and it's not letting me open it for some reason. Scroll down here. When things in your life seem almost too much to handle, when 24 hours in a day is not enough, remember the mayonnaise jar and 2 cups of coffee. A professor stood before his philosophy class and had some items in front of him. When the class began, wordlessly, he picked up a very large and empty mayonnaise jar and fills it with golf balls. He then asked the students if the jar was full. They agreed that it was. The professor then picked up a box of pebbles and poured it into the jar. He shook the jar lightly. The pebbles rolled into the open areas between the golf balls. He then asked the students again if the jar was full. They agreed it was. The professor next picked up a box of sand and poured it into the jar. And, of course, the sand filled up everything else. He asked once more if the jar was full. The students responded with a unanimous yes. The professor then produced two cups of coffee from under the table and poured the entire contents into the jar, effectively filling the empty space between the sand. The students laughed. "Now," said the professor, as the laughter subsided, "I want you to recognize that this jar represents your life. The golf balls are the important things. God, family, children, health, friends, and favorite passions. Things that if everything else was lost and only they remained, your life would still be full. The pebbles are the things that matter, like your job, your house, your car. The sand is everything else, the small stuff," he said. "If you put the sand into the jar first," he continued, "there's no room for the pebbles or the golf balls.
Wow.
If you spend all your time and energy on the small stuff, you will never have room for the things that are important to you," he told them. "So, pay attention to the things that are critical to your happiness. Worship with your family. Play with your children. Take your partner out to dinner. Spend time with good friends. There will always be time to clean the house and fix the dripping tap. Take care of the golf ball first, the things that really matter. Set your priorities. The rest is just sand." One of the students raised her hand and inquired what the coffee represented. The professor smiled and said, "I'm glad you asked. It just goes to show you that no matter how full your life may seem, there's always room for a couple cups of coffee with a friend."
Wow. That was great.
And there's a wonderful picture of this professor standing in front of his classroom. This is awesome. I have this on my front page on Facebook, and I've had so much feedback about this that you realize that everybody gets it, you know.
Well, you know what?
I don't think everybody always remembers it, and I don't think everybody practices it, but they all get it. And the truth of the matter is, this is the only chance you get. I even heard from Jill Swires, a very good friend of ours who lives in the UK.
Oh, wow.
She says, "Excellent. This has given me an idea. I will also use this story. Thank you." This story came to us also from my friend Lynn, and I love it. Thank you, Lynn. So, at the end of the day, let's have a little summation here. At the end of the day, we know that we need some help in the schools. We know that, like we have said a million, if not a trillion times, we need to be better leaders and set better examples. I mean, right now we've got all this stuff going on with Syria, and instead of everybody worrying about that fact, what's everybody concentrating on? They're trying to figure out how to bash Obama and see what kind of mistakes he makes about this. Now, what kind of people don't want the man that's running the United States of America to make the right decisions instead of waiting patiently, giggling in the background, hoping he's going to screw up? People, this is your life. You know, I don't understand why, if you think he's doing something wrong, do something about it. If you think he could make better decisions, do something about it. You know, it doesn't count if all you do is talk behind somebody's back and never help them change. That doesn't help anything. Nothing.
That's right.
And we have all these things going on. You know, like I said, all this stuff, and are we going to get involved? Aren't we going to get involved? We are involved. We're not going to get, we might not get, we could get, we should get. We are, because we're a part of the big picture. And it doesn't have anything to do with what we do next. We're already here. We're already there. We're already everywhere. I sound like Dr. Seuss.
this is a part of our world, and we are involved. And, of course, now choices are important. And it's the same with here at home. But, again, I don't know how to make this any clearer to people, and I am no wise shaman. I'm an old woman who's made more mistakes than I care to share with anybody. However, the truth is the truth. You look around you and you see that you have to start at the beginning. You have to start where you start, which is yourself, and then your surroundings, and then you can move outward. And it's the same with the United States of America. And I stand very strong on this, right or wrong, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But we have to take care of here at home. If we're still having kids stabbing each other at 7:30 in the morning on their way into school, we still have major problems. If we still have a 74-year-old man who, because he bumped his head and because nobody's had time to check him and make sure that the bump on his head healed, takes everything away from him, including his personal integrity, his money, his home, his everything, and leaves him just this old man sitting in a room who knows who he is, knows where he is, and wonders where the hell his own stuff is, and all these other things that we know that are happening that we talk about all the time. Syria is a major problem. So are all the other things that are going on in all the other countries. Everybody has problems. But you know what? It's just like a family. If you take care of your problems and I took care of my problems, things would clean themselves up in a rather good order, don't you think? If every time I turn around, I'm trying to fix you instead of fixing me, eventually I'm the weakest link. And that's not what we're looking for. We're looking to all be strong, and we're looking to all be able to do what we're supposed to do. So let's start here first. Let's start here. Let's support. Let's protect those that we can protect. But let's please start here, where the problems get bigger every day, and the violence, the hatred. All these years, the day that I read the Martin Luther King speech, and I realized that people have felt that way for so long, then what the hell is wrong with us? If we get it, why don't we do it? I don't understand. So now we have all of these things, and then we have the beautiful teacher's summation with the golf balls. And at the end of the day, that's the truest statement we made all morning, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and that's the type of teacher that we've talked about. That
I lost you,
honey. Can you hear what I'm saying?
No, I didn't hear a word.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Am I a little bit clearer?
Yes, you're good now.
I think the teachers talked about before. That puts heart into their day. It's not just a job. They're just not showing up to do a 9-to-5. You know, obviously, that was very... Yeah, it was very...
Shell, you're gone completely. I think what Shelley's saying, correct me if I'm wrong, Shell, is that after we talked about the teachers and the workload and the things that are going on and the things that you shared... we lost her entirely now. The things that we shared in the very beginning at the school and some of the other things that are going on, and Shelley talking about the homework that she helped her grandniece with. We have some wonderful teachers that are doing things that they're supposed to be doing, and that professor is certainly one of them. And at the end of the day, when we have professors like that that can teach kids what they need to know and give them the worth that everybody's in search of, then that's the perfect story. Do I have you back, Shelley?
Yeah, you got me back. We're having power outages out here, so it must be affecting electricity and stuff like that. So
okay,
but,
so
yeah, I'm back.
Just, the summation. So I think I finished your thoughts. You were talking about the fact that after we talked about the teachers and the responsibility and the tragedy that happened in Texas, you're talking about this professor who was able to teach a true life lesson to his class,
right,
which was beautiful.
Right, exactly.
And where do you stand about helping what we just talked about with the president? Here he is making all these decisions instead of anybody trying to support him and realizing that he's got the weight of our world on his shoulders. They're standing in the background hoping he's going to make some terrible mistake.
Well, the bottom line is, and we've discussed this before, okay, he's not making these decisions unilaterally. I mean, he presented his case to Congress, and they agreed with him. So, if you're going to be upset about the decision, then you have to be upset with the entire faculty that's behind the president. Obama's not making these decisions unilaterally. So it's nonsense when people say the president that, because there's always other people involved that are in the decision. They're looking at all the facts, they're debating, and they're making the decision to move forward in a particular way. So if you don't like it, then start writing your congressman, go to Washington, be proactive, do something about it. Otherwise, stop muddying the waters with all this discontent, because it serves no purpose other than to get everybody riled up, and here you have a people that aren't even behind their own government. It's just not the right way to be.
Right. It's like in a family. In every family, you have the pot stirrer, I call them. The one who
mm-hmm.
likes to see everybody in some kind of discord and talks about everybody else behind their backs, or in the workplace, or in your church community. There's always somebody who's so unhappy with themselves that they like to keep the pot stirred. And that's what we're doing with the whole world right now. Stop it,
right,
everybody. It doesn't serve you, and it doesn't serve anybody else. You have got to learn that we're in this together. And the more supportive we are of each other, the stronger we become. Not the more demeaning, not the more slanderous. You don't build anything by tearing it down. And if you do, I'd like to see how you manage it. But you cannot build anything, your life, your home, your family, your world, if you're continuously knocking it down. It doesn't work that way.
All right. Right. Instead of being critical and criticizing, discuss other options. And if you're talking with other people and you're saying, you know, I wish they weren't doing this, I think this is a better idea, or what do you think we could be doing? You know, if you discuss it in a positive, what if you got a couple other people that said and agreed with you and came up with a better idea, and then you could start a movement? I mean, how do you think all these changes happen? Because you have one person that does that, they get other people behind them, they go to Congress, and they get laws passed, and they get things changed, and they get things improved. So you're either part of the problem if you just sit back and criticize, or you can be part of the solution if you brainstorm with people and then bring a solution to the powers that be. That's the way to do it.
Exactly. If you really, really disagree with something, which is certainly everyone's prerogative, then do something that's productive. You know, don't do something that just tears things down. Negativity and judgmental behavior is our biggest downfall. It's our biggest downfall in our relationships, in the way we handle many, many things. We've got to learn how to keep building instead of destroying. And until we do that, things will always be awry. Things will always be in discord. And again, if you're a grown-up and you have a family, you're supposed to be leading the way you want your predecessors to lead after you're gone. So think about that today. I want everybody to have a wonderful, wonderful day. I want everybody to appreciate the fact that we're all still here. We're all still walking and talking and singing if we feel like it. And I will not be on tomorrow morning. Spike has to go back to the hospital for some more tests. I will be back on the air Monday morning. Thank you, Shelley, and I see I've had Valerie with me most of this morning. Thank you, Valerie. Everybody have a beautiful day. Bye-bye and God bless. Bye, Shel. See you in a little while.
Yes. All right. Bye, everyone. Have a great day.